Laurie Garrett on the spread of contagious diseases in a world out of balance. We were all brought up to believe that by now all we had to worry about is cancer, heart disease, and Alzheimer's. Infectious diseases from tuberculosis to measles to malaria or cholera were supposed to have become extinct, or at least controlled. However, today infectious diseases are on the rise. They are spreading rapidly across borders, often mutating into new strands for which there is no cure or resistance. New diseases like HIV and Ebola are highly contagious and incurable. Close to half of the people who die globally die of an infectious or parasitic disease. Laurie Garrett is the author of The Coming Plague, New Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. She spoke in October of 1995 in Berkeley, California.
When we came out of World War II, there was a sense of extraordinary optimism in the world, especially in America. We had virtually all the capital in the world, all the money, all the cash reserves. We had been utterly victorious. We hadn't just vanquished our enemies, we had decimated them. We'd invented a whole new form of weaponry that broke all new laws of physics. And MacArthur and Eisenhower were in agreement on one thing. It was a rare experience that they agreed on anything. And that was that they could have won the war more rapidly had it not been for malaria. In particular, in the Pacific theater, MacArthur estimated that at any given time, about a third of his troops either had malaria or were convalescing from malaria. So the two of them said, all right, well, let's just start out. Goal number one, let's get rid of malaria. They had already, by the end of World War II, through the use of DDT, which was 100% effective at that time in eliminating mosquitoes that carried malaria, and the use of chloroquine, been able to wipe out much of the malaria here in Europe, pushed it down to Sicily and so on. And there was a lot of optimism about getting rid of all the malaria in North America and probably Mexico. And the optimism was so tremendous, and the tools looked so powerful, chloroquine, DDT, that over in Indonesia they put chloroquine in table salt, set it out in all the restaurants. And DDT was used so heavily in Latin America to get rid of the mosquitoes that people's houses would be caked with the powder, and they were encouraged not to wash it off, leave it there for a couple of years. They set a goal. 5 years was all it was going to take to rid the world of malaria, and this is where we are today. We have shrunk the geographic area of malaria. We haven't got it, at least not this today, in North America. But we have actually expanded the area in Central America. It's actually not just on the coastline anymore. And we've had no success to speak of in Asia or certainly in Africa. What this chart doesn't really adequately portray is how thoroughly we've been defeated, because more people are dying today on planet Earth of malaria than were back when we set out to eradicate it. Furthermore, our key weapons don't work particularly well anymore. We have pest vectors that are now resistant to DDT and to one level of pesticides after another that have been applied. And as far as the malarial parasite itself goes, chloroquine resistance is now pretty much universal in the Amazon region, most of East Africa and far West Africa, and you'd be ill-advised to use chloroquine as your primary prophylaxis as a traveler anywhere in this region. So we go to the secondary drug, mefloquine, otherwise known as Lyrium. Well, besides the fact that it has nasty side effects that include psychotic depression, been there, it also has been rendered non-efficacious in much of the world, particularly, again, the same areas, the Amazon, East Africa, and parts of Southeast Asia, due to parasite resistance that has emerged. Now, to make matters much, much worse, in the Thai-Cambodia border region, in the area held by Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge, an altogether new strain of malaria has emerged that actually has a pump mechanism in the outer part of the parasite that pumps out every drug that comes the parasite's way. So essentially, for all intents and purposes, at this time, it is incurable malaria. When we came out of the World War II era, we started setting goals for diseases that we were going to eradicate. And what we meant was, we're going to take a whole species of microorganism and destroy it on planet Earth. right? So that was our goal. That was our biological and strategic plan. It was very much a World War II type plan. We were so convinced of it because it was the Russians that heard that we were going to eliminate malaria and felt, well, out of Cold War, what you have it. They had to come up with a better one. So they said, okay, we're all going to eliminate smallpox. Their luck was they picked the one that was actually doable for biological reasons. And by 1977, it was clear we had eradicated smallpox from planet Earth. So in 78, there was a meeting held called the Alma-Ata Conference, at which representatives of public health from all over the world gathered and resolved a battle strategy. And by this date, we would have eradicated these diseases, and by that date, these diseases, and these diseases. And, you know, trying out the top of the list was cholera. It seemed so doable. It was susceptible to antibiotics. It's a bacterial disease. It's carried in filthy water. Clean the filthy water. Give people antibiotics. End of cholera, right? So we were supposed to have eliminated this by the 1980s. And in fact, today we have three simultaneous pandemics of three totally different new strains sweeping across the world. And we also have learned something we didn't know when we set out to eradicate it, which if we had known, we probably would never have been silly enough to think we could eradicate cholera from planet Earth. And that is that most new strains of cholera appear in this region, in the Bengal Sea, India, Bangladesh. It has to do with the ecology of the area and the way the people live in and on the land, which is to say that the water is everywhere and the water is everybody's sewer, and that most human waste goes entirely untreated into the ecology. It turns out the human waste feeds the algal population, and they have huge algal blooms constantly in this area. Well, it also turns out that the Vibrio cholera is capable of exuding all of its water and shrinking itself down in size by 300% and then living inside of algae. So it turns out the Vibrio can go insert itself into the algae and then make its way around the world in tidal blooms, red tides, or, as happened a couple of years ago, get picked up by ships that load bilge water. The ship comes around, docks off Lima, unloads the bilge water. The algae and the Vibrio inside of them get absorbed into local shellfish, and the people eat ceviche, and voila, cholera epidemic. We're also in a bad state of affairs with tuberculosis right now. Indeed, there are more people dying of tuberculosis in the world today than at any time in the 20th century. If this regional map put together a few months ago by WHO, to give you a sense of the scale of things, the darkest brown color means that more than 100 people die out of every 100,000 in the population every year from TB. If it doesn't show you a few specific hotspots like my hometown, New York City, where we have our own lovely little pandemic underway, or epidemic. And I'm sure most of you have heard about the epidemic that really exploded in New York City in 1990, driven in large part by a new mutant strain that had emerged because of improper antibiotic use. It's called the W strain. It is resistant to every known anti-tubercular drug. If you get the W strain, your odds of survival should you come down with tuberculosis will be exactly the same as they would have been for your grandparents, 50-50. Modes of treatment, exactly the same as they would have been for your grandparents. And we have no new drugs in the pipeline for this one. The problem is even more profound in the poorest parts of the world, India and sub-Saharan Africa in particular, because in those areas where we're now seeing resistance to the two primary frontline drugs for TB, INH and rifampin, no one can afford to go to the alternative drugs. They not only are a good deal more expensive, but the side effects are extremely difficult to manage. Side effects that may include loss of hearing, loss of eyesight, etc. As a result, where we see now about 10-15% of all tuberculosis in Africa is INH and rifampin resistance, what that means to Africa is incurable TB for economic reasons. Well, we were all brought up to believe that by now, the only things we'd be worrying about were cancer, heart disease, and Alzheimer's. We were supposed to be hitting this new health transition where the infectious diseases were history, and all we had to worry about were these chronic disease problems. But according to WHO, this is what killed people in the world 2 years ago. Infectious and parasitic diseases accounted for a third of all deaths in the world. And we know now that a substantial portion of cancer is in fact caused by viral infection and in at least one case bacterial. In addition, we have to assume infectious causes for many neonatal and respiratory deaths. And a good percentage of the unknown causes of death, one have to assume, are infectious diseases. So somewhere close to half of all death in the world is now due to infectious and parasitic diseases. But this is where the funding is. This is how much foreign aid of all foreign aid dollars donated by all wealthy countries to all poor countries combined went for infectious diseases. And lest you think that 1.5% sounds unreasonably small, let me tell you that here in the United States, at our Centers for Disease Control, the situation has changed rather dramatically since we created the CDC 49 years ago. Because originally it was called the Centers for Communicable Diseases, and all they did, 100% of their budget, was infectious diseases. Today, it's called the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and every year, Congress has been redefining more and more things as diseases and commanding CDC to be in charge of their control. So alcoholism is now a CDC job. Child brutality is a CDC job. Family violence is a CDC job. Teen pregnancy is a CDC job. What percentage of the entire CDC budget do you think is devoted to infectious diseases other than AIDS and TB? 2%. So it's not a whole lot better than this. In fact, Dustin Hoffman made more money this year playing a disease fighter in the movie Outbreak than the entire annual budget of the National Center for Infectious Diseases. The real warning shot, the final coup de grace that should have awakened us all to the notion of how silly it was to believe that we had vanquished the microbes and there were no surprises to come, was HIV, the cause of AIDS. This is 1986 here, when the AIDS quilt filled about half of the Washington Mall. The last time we were able to fit it in the mall was 1988, when it finally reached all the way to the Capitol. And in fact, we no longer have any place in the metropolitan United States where we can show the quilt in its entirety. It's too big. With over 200,000 AIDS deaths, we're clearly facing a major crisis, one that we choose to ignore at our peril. And of course, when HIV first appeared, because the ideology of the day in medicine was that we had vanquished infectious diseases, and for every disease there would be a pill. You see a health set of symptoms and a problem, go to the physician's desk reference, look it up for the right drug, and say, ah, that looks like penicillin to me. It seemed appropriate then for gay men in particular, and anyone who felt that they were part of a group at high risk for HIV infection, to try to shout the cure out of a test tube. To say there had to be some bureaucratic reason why the cure wasn't there, or some homophobic rationale, something in government, something in politics, something in the pharmaceutical industry that was about prejudice and bigotry, that would explain why, in this era when all infectious diseases had supposedly been conquered, a cure had not been found. But of course, we have no idea how to get a virus out of your body that infects your DNA. We don't know how to get it out with destroying your genetic integrity in the process, and therefore killing you. This is a whole new realm. We've never before confronted, that we know of, a virus that was capable of infecting our own DNA. Internationally, the toll that HIV is taking is absolutely astonishing. There's an area in around Lake Bukoba, Lake Victoria, in the district of Bukoba, northern Tanzania, that I've gone to several times, looking at the course of this epidemic and the impact it's had. This little 9-year-old is raising 4 little kids younger than she. And this teenage boy is raising all his cousins. These are all AIDS orphans. In the village of Kanyigo, you'd be hard-pressed to find any adults between 20 and 45 years of age. They've all died of AIDS. And you multiply that times hundreds of villages. The tragedy here is not just the loss of the lives of those particular individuals who have died, but tell me, who's going to teach this little girl so that she can teach these little boys what it means to be a Kanyigan? What is the history of her people? Who settled the village? Where did they come from? Who were their parents and their grandparents and their great-grandparents? What's their cultural legacy? Are there special festivals they're supposed to celebrate? What do they mean? How do you read? What languages will you learn to speak? If you multiply this, all these children, times hundreds of thousands of children in villages all over sub-Saharan Africa, you begin to appreciate we're not just looking at the tragedy of the immediate loss of life, but the devastation of a culture and the devastation of economy. How will these kids grow up to be productive workers? Now, what's that going to mean to Tanzania, to Uganda, to Kenya, multiplied times country after country in Africa? I was speaking earlier this week at the State Department on this matter, and they were telling me they've completed reports that show that in the areas hardest hit by HIV in sub-Saharan Africa, they're expecting that because of the children have been left orphaned and there is no one to raise them and feed them properly and have them immunized, they're looking at a 4- to 5-fold increase in child mortality in the next 10 years. Child mortality meaning numbers of kids who survive to the age of 10. In fact, by every development marker that we measure the successful progress of a nation, AIDS combined with tuberculosis is pushing sub-Saharan Africa backwards. Infant mortality going up, child mortality going up, life expectancy going down, gross national product going down, gross domestic product going down, productive level trained workforce going down. This is the extremely conservative and just last week readjusted estimates by WHO of the extent of HIV in the world. They just doubled this figure. So we're now estimated to be up at a level of about 30 million cumulative HIV cases in the world. And in fact, even that is considered a very conservative estimate of the total. The only thing that's useful, I think, about this is it gives you a sense of proportionality. Where are the most cases occurring? The only part of this I would quibble with in terms of proportionality is Southeast Asia and India. From my observations in India, I think that it is not only the fastest growing epidemic in the world today, but that India's cumulative HIV total will, within 10 years, exceed the cumulative sub-Saharan Africa combined all nations total. And we only have one tool, really, the condom. One way to really slow the spread of all this. And there's a problem with this tool. It's controlled by only one gender. And it happens to be controlled by the gender in power. In most of the world where the women are at high risk, they have no free will. If you go to the brothels of Asia, these women were sold to the brothels by their parents in childhood, or by husbands who wanted to get rid of them. Or they were lured in as indentured servants with promises that after a year or two they would have earned their way out of their contracts and be free again. And then they find they never can earn their way out, and they're stuck in a life of prostitution. They can no more insist that their customer use a condom than they can get out of the life of prostitution altogether. As long as the only tool we have is one that only one gender can control, and it's the gender that also has the power, we have very limited efficacy. And until we can come up with some way that women can protect themselves independent of the other gender, we're going to have very limited success in much of the world and almost no success in Asia. And of course, the next thing that brings things onto the radar screen in policy circles in Washington is the recognition in May of this year that the Ebola virus had made a return after 19 years to the nation of Zaire. In the south of Zaire, in the city of Kikwit, rather than where it emerged in 76 in the far north in the city of Yambuku. The virus is an old nemesis, one that holds a special place of concern, even fear, among a lot of scientists because of the tremendous lethality of the virus and the horrific symptoms it produces. The virus specifically inhabits endothelial tissue, which means the lining of your blood vessels and your capillaries, your primary organs such as your heart and your liver and so on, and begins gnawing away little holes, which in the first level of infection results in the water draining out. But as the holes get bigger, whole blood cells pour out and the liver and so on begin to lose all their integrity and sort of melt away. Eventually, people will be hemorrhaging and bleeding externally from every orifice, and it's quite painful, produces horrible fevers, and many people end up entirely deranged in their final hours before death. And that derangement produces another layer of fear in the populace when they see these patients. they called on this gentleman, Dr. Tamfu Muyembe, from the University of Kinshasa, one of Zaire's most famous scientists, and asked him to come in and help them figure out what was going on. And the whole world is extremely lucky for the coincidence that the doctor who came in as the expert had been involved in 1976 in the epidemic in Yambuku, the first known outbreak of Ebola. This is Gaspar Menga, who died on January 13th. This is his funeral. Everybody you see touching him, with the exception of his brother Pierre, died of Ebola. 13 out of 23 members of this family, the Menga family, died of Ebola in January and February of this year. The good news is we may know where this virus came from, which we never knew in previous outbreaks. Gaspar Menga made charcoal for a living. He went into the rainforest in this area, and he would get trees and put them in a big pit and burn them down into charcoal, and then take the charcoal back into town and sell it as fuel. And to make enough charcoal to be worth the trip, he would have to spend a couple of weeks camped out in the rainforest. He had just done so shortly before he took ill. About 37,000 insect and animal samples were collected in this rainforest area and are now at the Maximum Security Biosafety Lab in Atlanta at the CDC. Unfortunately, we can't start mashing them up right away and finding out which ones contain virus, because it turns out our knowledge of what species exist in the rainforest is so poor that we can't identify most of them. They're bringing in scientists from all over the place to assist the CDC, but it's thought that a substantial percentage of the species that have been recovered from the area have never been classified or identified. So you can't mash them up till you've at least given them a name, classified them in some way, so that you could go back and find them again in the ecology. Therefore, we're probably going to be at least a year before we'll know the answer, whether or not we've lucked out and finally found out where this virus hides when it's not causing human epidemics. The good news is we know that the virus that emerged in kikwit is identical to the strain genetically that surfaced in 1976 in Yambuku. So the virus isn't changing. Whatever reason it comes and goes has to do with us, our species, not the virus. And there are a few things that are worth noting that I think are reasons to pause and consider why we're at greater risk today than 20 or 30 years ago. One is that we're on the move. Never before has our species been taking airplanes as much, going as many places, immigrating on the scale that we're immigrating, being refugeed out of high-intensity localized warfares that claim civilians as targets, as we are today. In fact, these figures on international air travel jumping in 1950 from 2 million passengers a year internationally getting on flights to another country to, by 1990, 280 million are lowball, because this is the 1990 level is what occurred before the fall of the Berlin Wall. Once all the Cold War restrictions on international travel were lifted, things have really soared out of control. And in fact, the International Air Transportation Association estimates that when the numbers come in the year 2000, we will have probably witnessed a logarithmic jump between the 1990 level and the year 2000 level. In fact, earlier this week at the National Academy of Sciences, they were saying that they now estimate 1 million people a day in the world cross an international border. The other trend that is occurring all over the world is urbanization. People are abandoning the rural areas and moving into the cities. The trend is rather dramatic. In North America and Europe, we basically urbanized to a fairly stable level, but it took us about 250 years to do so, to our current levels, allowing us time to build our infrastructures to support those people living in the cities in a relatively healthy manner. But look at Latin America. In 1970, 57% of the population of Latin America was urban. By 1990, 72%. And it's estimated by 2025, 84% of the population will be urban. Africa, from 23 to 32 to 54% in the same time span. When you urbanize that rapidly, you obviously cannot build supporting infrastructures, especially if your country is impoverished to begin with. Where are these urbanization patterns occurring? What are the new big cities of the future? Well, according to the United Nations, the fastest growing cities in the world, that will end up by year 2000 having populations in excess of 10 million, are lovely garden spots such as Dhaka, Bombay, Calcutta, Delhi, Jakarta, Baghdad, Tehran, Bangkok, Istanbul, Mexico City. Any of you that have traveled to these places know what I'm talking about. The majority of the population lives in areas with substandard at best housing, no running water, no decent sewage facilities, basically no public health infrastructure. In other words, microbe heaven. We also see that a global trend that in these giant cities, people are bringing their rural ecology to the urban setting. So they're co-living in highly dense situations with their pigs, their chickens, their goats, their cows. And you see the animals eating the human garbage mixed with the human waste, and then the animals defecating in areas that the humans will be in contact with. A perfect opportunity for the transmission of animal microbes to humans, or, as we often see with viruses such as influenza, for the mutation of the microorganism as it goes from one species to another, coming full circle back to produce something like swine flu, which we experienced in 1918, killing 22 million people worldwide. The New Scientist, the British science publication, posed this rhetorical question: can we afford not to track deadly viruses? And of course their answer is a double negative. No, we cannot not afford, well, anyway. And I think that that's the key message here when people ask, what's all this about Ebola, or what's all this about plague in India, or what's all this about whatever remote issue, is that each of these are warning shots across the bow to our species. And each of these outbreaks provides us with lessons that we either learn or we suffer continued repetition of these things until another HIV-like agent comes forward and sweeps over successfully our entire global public health system.
You heard part one of an hour-long talk by Laurie Garrett, author of The Coming Plague, New Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. In part two, Laurie Garrett reports on the emergence of the plague in India. She explains how global warming allows disease-carrying insects like mosquitoes to migrate into new areas, while at the same time the warming process kills many animals, like amphibians, who previously kept the insect population under control. Laurie Garrett also addresses questions of food safety and public health, and comments on the commonly asked question whether some of these new global diseases have been created and spread by individuals or government agencies. A cassette copy or a printed transcript of the full one-hour talk is $9. For $15, you get both, the audio cassette and the transcript. Send your check to TUC Radio, Box 41009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's TUC Radio, Box 41009, San Francisco, California, 94141. My name is Mariah Gallardon. Thank you for listening.